When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Today here, qua host only, is Thea Lenarduzzi. Hello, Thea.
Hello, hello.
I'm continuing the qua thing.
Yeah, I noticed.
The other thing is, should we mention Alippo as an Olympian constraint of this podcast, or is that too much?
I think maybe our Olympian constraint should be that we must not mention Ulipo in every podcast.
The first rule of Freedom of Books, Flowers and the Moon podcast is not mentioning Ulipo.
Yeah.
All right, done. If you like Ulipo and that sort of thing, and I'm sure you do, do get subscribing to the TLS. I think this week's edition, I really do think this is one of the best we've done, although I would say that, of course. Here's a cheap offer for you. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. That's podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. That's the-tls.co.uk/pod19. And you'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. On today's show, Claire Loudon asks the unimprovable question, do the kids still read John Updike? The answer in the world of identity politics and the questioning of male privilege is almost certainly no. But should they? She makes a powerful defence. Her piece this week is one of the best in my time as editor, and she'll be here to talk us through it. Toby Lichtig knows a bit about Updike, being our fiction editor, so he'll join us for that chat. And he's also written a piece about Chelsea Manning, having watched a new documentary of her life. So he'll come for the patriarchal novelist and stay for the transgender disruptor of American society. And retaining our American theme, what with this being Independence Day week, Eric Rauchway has written about American Nazis and their prevalence in the 40s. And nothing celebrates a wonderful, vibrant nation quite like discussing its far-right precursors to the present day. I can first remember consuming the Rabbit books by John Updike in one glorious prolonged gulp, all 4 of them in the Everyman edition, 1,500 pages of expansive precision about Harry Angstrom, surely an Everyman for all literature. My period of fiction reviewing, which followed a few years later, coincided, alas, with Updike's dotage. Every couple of years I'd open another new novel, The Widows of Eastwick, Villages, Terrorist, with a familiar sense of proleptic disappointment. Please don't write badly about sex and boringly about everything else, I thought. And he did. I really felt that his late work was damaging that great reputation. So it's really nice to read Claire Loudon magnificently examining the writing of early Updike, his first 4 novels, including the apocryphal Rabbit Run. She uses the opportunity to pose some considered questions like, are the kids reading John Updike now? Answer, probably not, but that may be because of politics rather than aesthetics, Updike committing the cardinal sin of writing big, confident novels full of sex and thinly veiled autobiography, or being a penis with a thesaurus, in the words of one female critic. Loudon mounts the case for the defence, not least by following one of Updike's rules from his own outstanding literary criticism. Try to understand what the author wished to do, and do not blame him for not achieving what he did not attempt. A noble, almost utopian sentiment that dates him far more than his fiction does. Fairness is not very 2019. Nobody told Claire Loudon that, and she's happily here to talk fairly about John Updike now. Claire, hello.
Hi.
So, it is 2019, sadly in some respects. What is the reputation of John Updike? If I say John Updike to people who've read him or have heard of him, what do you think they think?
I think that a lot of people probably remember the later novels, as you do. I hope that a lot of people think straight away of the short stories, which for me are some of the best things that he wrote. And I think people think straight away of Rabbit. I think those are the things that encapsulate Updike. I also, as you can tell from the piece, worry that people hear Updike and think has been, and think that he's old news, especially younger people. But perhaps you guys think I've been too squeamish there. You're actually the first people I've really spoken to about this.
No, I mean, I think not has been. I think they think creepy old man, they think of it through the context of a certain degree of identity politics. He writes a lot about the male gaze, and that's not very trendy now. It's challenged very often now.
But do we know that? Do we know, have his sales slumped? I mean, is this just an impression?
I think there is some whispering in the, and you talk about this in the piece, Claire, that there's a kind of view of Bellow, view of Roth, view of Updike.
And you can extend that backwards, actually, to Thomas Hardy, who gets quite a bad rap these days for the male gaze. And Dickens, people are saying, kind of, why would you bother with Dickens? I have definitely heard both of those two recently spoken about as kind of, we're done with all that.
I wonder if they're cut a bit more slack of distance, though, whereas, you know, we all remember Updike being alive still.
He should have known better.
He should have known better, because, you know, it was only a handful of years ago that he was still with us, even though Rabbit might have been written.
Well, you make the point that these books are, you're reading four books written in the 50s. These feel old-fashioned books, though, in the sense of not old-fashioned with the writing, but the setting is old-fashioned.
Yeah, and that really astonished me, actually, because I read Rabbit years and years ago. And, I mean, I suppose kind of 12, 15 years ago, which technically isn't that long. But coming back to it now, I was shocked by how even further ago it felt than it did when I first read it.
Yeah.
Did you experience the rabbits very differently then, rereading?
Did you
love them the first time, and then when you went back to them more recently, you...
I think that's probably true, actually. Certainly of Rabbit Run, which I just remembered as a sort of outright masterpiece, actually.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's... there are bits of it that are better than pretty much anything else in that time period. But taken as a whole, I think it's got problems. And I certainly didn't see that reading it as a younger reader.
We'll talk about the problems in a moment. David Foster Wallace, is he possibly responsible for the beginnings of the turn against Updike? Because he talks about the great male narcissists, as he calls them, and he places Updike in that canon, which is very... And I remember, the reason why I think people do say this is when writers die, you get people... I've seen this on social media. When Roth died, everyone's saying, why are you only talking about Roth? You're only talking about Roth because he's white and male. You're not talking about other great authors. And there is a line that is Updike, Roth, Bellow, and they are white male authors. But that doesn't mean there are no authors of colour out there. It's just that they happen to represent a certain tradition that did exist.
And many people's eyes does still exist. I think Jonathan Franzen and Jonathan Safran Foer are very much kind of in that pocket still today. And people hated Safran Foer's last book, which I thought was rather good, actually. And it seemed to be as much about who he represented as a person as about the novel itself, I thought.
So what did David Foster Wallace said? He basically said, this is where he quotes an unnamed female reader in the penis with the thesaurus.
He quotes a bunch of different women that he's spoken to about Updike, and I suppose this is partly what I had in my head when I was thinking about the way we see him now, because that review is back, I suppose, is it in the, it's, I've got the date
97.
There.
97,
exactly. And already at this point Foster Wallace is claiming that he's going to parties and he's saying, kind of, what do you think of Updike? And everyone's saying, why would you read him, he's a penis with a thesaurus. He quotes about four or five different very, very negative reactions.
Total number of pages about Mexico's repossession of the American Southwest, 0.1. Total number of pages about Ben Turnbull's penis and his various feelings about it, 7.5. But that is true of Updike. I mean, one of the criticisms I think of late Updike, and this is my... There is a legitimate criticism, is there, of aging male novelists who have no business in writing about sex and write about it embarrassingly.
Why do they have no business writing about it?
Yeah, why do they?
Because they write about it so embarrassingly. And it seems to me they write about it with an element of fantasy. If you look at Qureshi, Jacobson, Roth, Updike, virtually all of these novels, late novels, turn on old men having sex with young women. It seems to me. And there feels like, and this may be unfair, and then when that unembarrassed gaze of Updike, yet again for the 34th time, dwells upon the genitalia of someone else, it feels a bit like he's been there. And secondly, it is a bit creepy when a 75-year-old man writes about sex with a 30-year-old. Is that not right?
I mean, I don't think I can wholeheartedly agree. I understand the point in the main. If you end up with a very narrow canon where you've got prominent writers who are given lots of time and space because they have risen to great heights in their career, and they're using that time and space to write solely about one thing, whatever that one thing might be, I can see that that's problematic. But when it comes to the individual instance of a 75-year-old man writing about sex, if he's doing it well, fine. Yeah. I think you can easily argue that Updike isn't always doing it
particularly
well.
Particularly late. And I guess my point about late Updike is he's seldom doing it well. I mean, Villages is a... I don't know if you've read Villages.
I haven't read Villages.
But it is a constant series of descriptions of sex with virtually nothing else underpinning it. It's a kind of... And then in his later books, that happens very often. There's these and I don't think he's writing well at that point. I mean, maybe there's an issue about should authors in their dotage be allowed to publish books that ruin their reputation?
Because that's a very difficult and interesting question.
And you can sort of say that about any number of bands who keep gigging for way too long and they're kind of undoing all the good work that they've done. Who are you to stop them?
Well, you've also mentioned Late Roth, and there's an enormous amount in Late Roth, not necessarily the sex scenes. It's absolutely brilliant. So, I mean, exactly.
I would say Late Roth, the slight novels are do a disservice to his reputation.
And but the late 90s ones don't. And
when there's a difference between the late 90s novels and the 2000s novels. And Updike didn't write a good book for many years. Many, many years. And who am I to stop him? Exactly. I've no business, except the opinion that someone who likes him as a writer... Is it a shame? Is it a damage to someone's legacy? Another 2 years, another book comes out. It is not a good book. It has clearly not had the input of any editor because the person is so grand at that point.
Do we not see that?
I mean, I'm just offering this as a theory. Do we not see that with canonical great writers, that their last 10 years are filled with books that possibly could have been edited or not written or not published?
I think, again, talking generally in the main, there's a case for that, absolutely. And I actually, going back to what you were saying about how people receive Updike now, I almost wonder if in the late 90s, when Foster Wallace is writing that review, whether what you're describing is felt kind of more urgently because he's still writing and you're having to watch it happen.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, don't do it again. But yeah. Actually, we're now in this lovely position where he's lived a long and full life and he's gone, and we've got the whole body of work. And the great thing is that within that body of work, you can now look at it as a whole. There's enough that's gold there that you just think...
And that must be true. And the question is, do you think that fairness will exist? Do you think that ability to say, read the Rabbit books... For me, Rabbit is Rich the Third one, is peak Updike. That's almost a bit of Updike where he's just absolutely smashing it. And it's the early 80s and... He's got Harry Angstrom down exactly right. There's none of the weird Joycean flourishes.
which really kind of take over the first two, don't they?
Do you feel that in these 50s novels, you feel a bit of Joyce?
Oh, all the time. I mean, but that's another interesting thing is that he's such an unashamed fanboy of Joyce that it just kind of keeps sort of, he keeps getting hijacked by Joyce. Or I don't know what kind of hitching a lift with Joyce. I don't know what the right metaphor would be. But and when it happens, you admire the chutzpah, actually. You think, God, that's so obviously Joycean. I would never have the courage to go there if I were you. And then you think, well, it's also a bit naff. And then he gets away with it somehow in that he then goes on to do something Updikean and brilliant afterwards. And it's almost like he's using him as a stepping stone and or a crutch almost. And although it would be ideal if it didn't happen, you kind of understand that it has to happen to hoist him up into the position where he can go off on one of his brilliant kind of flights of microscopic detail that then zoom out into...
Yeah.
So is that what you would say is Updikean there?
Yeah, I think I would say it was Updikean. I think there's a phrase in Couples where he's not actually describing his own writing, obviously. He's describing sex and he's doing it very well. He talks about laminations of cross purpose. Between two couples in bed together, and actually being able to chart those really like shiftingly minute interactions between people, and spread that out, something that's taken place without words in the space of a few seconds, to spread that out over the space of a whole paragraph, and to do it intelligibly and not to bore the reader. That's just genius, I think.
But so is the problem that he...
I think of that as Updikean, yeah.
And is the Updikean approach to not have any sense of distinction between the subject matter sometimes? So you talk about how he writes about clouds. I think in Couples there's another example of surfaces, flat surfaces in Couples, like tar paper roofs. And
yes, yeah.
It's a bit too much. There's a feel that he pours the full glare of his imagination on things. And sometimes there are things that are worthy of that, and there's some things where it works and sometimes where it doesn't quite work. But you can, I suspect, reading your piece, and I would probably agree with this as well, to say that's worth it. That's the sort of, that's the price you pay for something as great as that.
Yeah, I'm nodding here. I agree with everything you just said about this sort of almost kind of indiscriminating micro gaze that he trains on everything. And sometimes you think he should have pulled back at this point and it would have, the whole thing would have had a bigger shape. I think partly, possibly, that's why the short stories often work better than the novels, because they're compressed. He's forced to be selective by the form.
You said that gaze is particularly effective when it comes to nature.
Yeah, I do. I think even in the toward the end of time,
which is not a great book,
that Foster Wallace is angry about. There are some beautiful moments of nature writing in that.
And gardening, and of the farm, you talk about this is rabbit gardening actually. Daffodils and narcissi unpack their trumpets. The shaggy golden suds of bloomy forsythia glow through the smoke that fogs the garden. He loves folding the hoed ridge of crumbs of soil over the seeds. Sealed, they cease to be his. The simplicity, getting rid of something by giving it to itself. God himself folded into the tiny adamant structure, self-destined to a succession of explosions. Now, that's beautiful. It's poetic. We can hear other voices maybe a bit in that. But it is also making a great deal of very little. Literally, the tiny seed becomes self-destined to a succession of explosions. Some people, I suspect, will think that's overripe.
Yeah,
they'll think
it's too pleased with itself. I think that's another criticism that gets levelled against very stylish writing.
James Wood says that a bit about it.
Yeah, I can imagine that, actually. Nabokov comes in for the same criticism, I think. I hate falling back on this. I wonder if you could say at this point that it's a matter of taste. For me, I think that's done beautifully. I think it becomes a problem, again, if we're talking about shape as a whole, if you have too much of it, but on the level of the sentence, I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, what do you think, Toby?
Absolutely. No, one of my guilty pleasures is one of his later novels, Brazil.
I haven't read that one.
It's a bit silly. It's his version of Tristan and Isolde told with an Amazonian setting. And Updike does magic realism.
Okay.
So there's a lot of luscious description, a lot of bad sex writing, a lot of very good sex writing. He's very good on, you've written for us on how to write about sex before, a very, very good piece about 3 or 4 years ago when you talk about the qualia of sex, and he's very, very good on that at times. You know, the smells and the particularity, and actually it's a very beautifully written book at times, a bit ornate for some taste, but I think when he hits that height, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
What will happen to him, do you think, in the future, Claire? Do you think he's destined to be a part of a culture war, because he is writing, has written rather, these novels that are unashamedly, and this is the point about not judging about except by what he's seeking out to do. He is a very male writer to lots of people in a time where that's a term of dispraise.
That's our time now. And I think I can't really answer the question, because you've got no idea how long this time that we're in, which I think we all know what we mean when we say that. It's getting a very specific, very localised feel to it. In a way that, I don't know whether you guys agree, that, say, 2005 didn't have a specific feel to it, but if you think about the 60s, we kind of know what we mean when we say that.
Yeah.
I think we're going to know what we mean when we talk about this time. I don't know how long it'll last, and I don't know whether we're going to care as much about the issues we're talking about a lot at the moment, especially issues surrounding gender. We've got no idea how that's going to play out. It's changing so fast.
Yeah.
For me, when I look forwards, a kind of an ideal future point will be the point where we care less about it in general. So many of the identity politics that we're dealing with now melt slightly because this period has naturally reduced our even noticing of gender. But I've got no idea how that will happen.
Yeah. There's a brilliant bit in your piece when you talk about what we might be looking at in 20 years' time. You say, the atrocities we're unconsciously committing in our novels today are probably something to do with the environment. All those casual plane journeys in Rachel Cusk's Outline trilogy, the takeaway coffee cups in Canal Scott. And I thought that was actually a brilliant observation. I mean, it might be slightly tongue-in-cheek, but possibly only slightly.
Yeah, I think only slightly, actually.
But probably only slightly, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the point is, we don't know what kind of morality we're going to be having in 20, 30, 40 years' time.
Yeah.
And I think what you're also saying is that we also need to judge literature and all art on its own terms and in the time it was written, as well as simply as whether it, you know, kind of lives up to our current ideals.
Because we will be judged. There'll be things we're doing now unconsciously that we don't know about. So.
Of course. I mean, I can sort of see this as maybe, like we read D.H. Lawrence now, we might read Updike.
I think there's a huge amount in common.
I mean, it's an interesting point, that, because Updike is probably as liable as D.H. Lawrence to damaging quotation, particularly in matters of sex. Lady Chatterley's Lover, you grab some passages of that, and Hemingway does it. They do that thing which Updike just about stops doing,
I know what you're going to say, and he doesn't do it, does he?
That sort of enacting of the sort of climactic roles in the sentences.
Very abstract. Referring to the ocean and the ocean's
pulsing. And it says things like pulsing, the ocean pulsing. Yeah. It's like we understand the biology of what you're doing here. And D.H. Lawrence, Hemingway does it actually as well, but Lawrence particularly so. And it's an interesting question, when Updike is as distant as Lawrence, what will we take from him? And that's impossible maybe to say.
I actually think that Lawrence is a really interesting comparison, because I think if you go back even 10 to 15 years ago, people were often a bit kind of ooh about Lawrence, but now it's a sort of badge of honour almost to be like a Lawrence fan. It's not exactly a closet Lawrence fan, but people say, oh, I really like D.H. Lawrence, and expect it to be something unusual. But so many people say it that actually basically everyone loves Lawrence.
Exactly.
Again.
And if they'd said that in the 80s or 90s, it would have been a whole different thing, because it was still too soon, I suppose.
Yeah. Maybe he'll get there. I hope he will. I hope that this period of animosity towards Bellow, I mean, that was a real surprise, talking to people about Bellow around the time that I was reading Leader's biographies, and just coming up against Bellow who or Bellow no were the two responses.
And the same happened with Roth when he died. You know, I remember saying something about Roth and people saying...
Interestingly, 20 years after David Foster Wallace wrote that piece, there's now a bit of a Foster Wallace backlash as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like he's not included in the canon of
glass houses.
White male narcissists.
Well, then that says, Claire, that John Updike is very lucky to have this... It's a 5,000-word piece, which I think is absolutely brilliantly sensitive to what he was trying to do. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you. I feel lucky. It was such a pleasure to return to him.
Hard to say what John Updike would have made of Chelsea Manning. In fact, it's hard to say what anyone should make of her. Is she, as she herself admitted in court, someone who illegally leaked information that endangered people's lives? A trust breaker? A traitor? Or is she a heroic figure determined to make public information that needed to be known, exposing the illegal acts of her nation, a martyr to free speech, a pioneer in support of justice? And, if anything, what does her gender matter to the story? Toby has watched XY Chelsea, a new documentary, and remains here to tell us if it really sheds any light on this most modern of figures. Toby, before we talk about the movie, the documentary, what do we need to know about Chelsea? What do people know about Chelsea?
What we do need to know about Chelsea is that she is a former US intelligence analyst. She was very young when she joined the army. She was 19. And she was he then. She was Bradley Manning. And after 2 years in the army, age 22, she downloaded and released to WikiLeaks an enormous tranche of documents. I think there were 750,000 of them in all. Relating to various, full of classified information, basically. There were three main tranches. There were what's known as the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs, and the diplomatic cables. And this caused an enormous furore, and she went to prison.
And the point is, there's no editing, there's no protecting of sources, there's no protecting of military assets or...
None whatsoever. Some were really sensitive, some were entirely classified, and her actions were entirely illegal, and she confessed and said
and
yes.
Some of them could have. Has ever been established the human cost of them?
Well, that's interesting. There was a recent report which said that the leaks didn't damage US security. What they did almost definitely do is endanger various Afghani and Iraqi sources who had been leaking information to the American army,
which in some ways is worse.
Yes, I mean it's a vexed thing. Whatever you think about what Chelsea Manning did, it hasn't come without consequences for some of the people who, you know, lower down the chain.
And the great WikiLeaks argument was we don't test the quality of information. We don't make editorial judgments. We just believe all information should be freely accessible. But that isn't quite true either, is it? Because they, in terms of dissemination, they prioritised certain information. They accentuated certain information in terms of how it was disseminated to people.
Absolutely. And it was leaked to WikiLeaks, but also the Guardian and the Washington Post did a kind of thorough filleting of the information. And it was how they presented it as well. And it came out in various tranches. It didn't sort of all come out in one go. So the story was kept running. And yeah, exactly. The way the story was told was also important, and what was chosen to be highlighted.
Well, as you say, I mean, it shone a vital spotlight on some pretty terrible goings on.
So for example, there were 15,000 unreported civilian deaths in the Iraq War that it revealed. That's a massively significant thing. There was footage of an infamous attack by an Apache helicopter, which took out a couple of Reuters journalists, and those deaths were recorded as enemies killed in action.
So and children as well.
Children as well, absolutely. Yeah. And it was from that point of view, for in terms of transparency on the occupation in Afghanistan and particularly Iraq, it shone an incredibly important spotlight. There was a cost. We've talked about the danger to various sources. I think it was a very valuable thing for her to have done. Whether it was the right thing to do, it can be valuable and wrong. And it was probably both those things.
And also it strikes me with WikiLeaks that it was never this agentless, entirely democratized release of information. There was an ego at the center of it, Julian Assange.
Absolutely.
Which we might get to.
And there's an ego to Manning as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the figure, we'll talk a little bit more about the film in a bit, but the figure that is presented is not without ego. She likes the spotlight, and she has this kind of overwhelming sense of her own ability to affect change, which is incredibly admirable, but also not without ego.
Obama commuted her sentence. He didn't pardon her. He just said she'd served enough hard time, and it was pretty hard time.
Well, she was sentenced for 35 years.
She got 35 years, which is, I mean, I think it's unprecedented for a leaker. And so this was deemed very, very harsh by various people. She also had a very difficult time inside. She struggled.
She transitioned.
So she was sentenced, I think, in 2013. I think she transitioned a year or two later. There was the difficulty of being in a male prison while she was transitioning, and then she'd already spent a lot of time in solitary confinement, which was obviously incredibly difficult, and she had a couple of suicide attempts, which were dealt with by further spells in solitary confinement. So she's very mentally vulnerable. Obama did decide to commute her sentence. This wasn't unusual for him. He commuted nearly 2,000 sentences over his 8 years in office, particularly in his final year. It's not uncommon for presidents to do a little bit of that at the end of their terms. But
Trump's going to do it, isn't he?
Well, yeah, Trump's
already
done
started.
It. You started with the likes of Conrad Black. Yeah. As I say in my piece, you know, you can tell a lot about a president by the sorts of people they choose to show clemency to. Mm. Obama's were mostly for drugs felons, given enormously long sentences. With Manning, he decided to let her go free. I think there was a political motive to this. I mean, of course there was. There was a sense, I think, that with Trump about to enter the White House, I think it was 3 days before Trump started, I think it's a message about transparency and a message about how leaking information may be needed over the next few years. So I think there was a kind of coded message in that. Also, I mean, I think he genuinely thought that it was a very tough sentence. But
presumably red-blooded, red-meat-eating Republicans were just like, what the hell are you doing? This is a traitor. I can't imagine there was a great deal of Republicans who felt...
Oh, absolutely not.
This was a harsh sentence, even.
No, they were aghast. I mean, and even, you know, for example, there was a piece in the Washington Post, which isn't the most right-leaning of the papers, basically saying it was a massive mistake. The Wall Street Journal said it was a massive travesty of justice. Lots of Republican speakers, Paul Ryan, highlighted the fact that
one of the great intellects of the age, highlighted the fact that
Manning, he called her this young woman or man or whatever she is, he is, you know, very dismissive of Manning as both a person and an individual. Obviously Trump thought it was a terrible thing. Further complicated by the fact that Manning then had a pop at Obama, which Trump uses as evidence that she was a traitor.
Well, why was she not grateful?
She was grateful for her sentence being commuted, but she didn't think Obama was a great leader. And actually,
she called him weak.
She called him weak. She said there have been very few permanent accomplishments in his
tenure. Well, they're all being undone now. And
so, yeah, exactly.
But it's possibly true anyway. I mean, one of the great arguments about Obama is this great figure on the Hill that we all love, particularly from a distance. What actually? How did he actually change the fabric of American society for better? Maybe he could never do it, but he certainly probably didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are only a few days after she was released, she wrote a piece for The Guardian, basically having a go at him and saying that he did too much compromise. So the fact that he let her off didn't change her politics and her opinion of him. And it's another example of her bravery.
Yeah, really,
she was prepared to come out and say, actually, this is what I believe in. She's, you know, she remains a campaigner for minority rights, for trans rights, and for transparency.
What is her legal status then? Because you were saying in your piece she's not out of prison entirely.
Well, she's not out of prison at all. So she was released. Then, a couple of years later, in fact, quite recently, I think it was earlier this year, she was subpoenaed to testify against Assange. She had to appear before a grand jury with, I think, characteristic bloody-mindedness. She objects to the whole grand jury process because it isn't transparent. You know, transparency is her main thing.
Yeah.
It's behind closed doors. She said she's already said everything she needs to say about what she did to the military tribunal. She's confessed to what she did. She doesn't believe in the grand jury process. She put her foot down and she's been in prison for it.
Does she want to defend Assange? Is that the reason?
No, I don't think so. I don't think she's not, she doesn't seem, and you see this from the film, she's not particularly interested in Assange, and she describes WikiLeaks as a means to an end. They haven't had much or any really personal contact. I think it's again, it's a matter of principle for her. She doesn't believe in the grand jury process. So she was in prison for a bit, then her subpoena expired, then it was immediately renewed. She's now been re-jailed, and I think it's another 17 months from here that term runs, which seems like an awful long time. Yep.
And she, in custody. And when she, do you see her in the film going back to jail?
The filming ends before the first subpoena comes in, but there's a kind of little line about it towards the end. And in fact, it's sort of tacked on. It's not actually dealt with.
You're
very
not thrilled
well
with this film, generally, are you?
I'm not thrilled. It's very interesting from the point of view of this. It's an impressionistic portrait, basically. So the filmmaker, Tim Travers Hawkins, has started filming the day we find out that she's getting released. And actually, the sort of the opening shots are her attorney's office and Obama's on the phone and she gets released. And we sort of follow her over the course of a year or so. And there are flashbacks to earlier on. If you don't know anything about her and her story, you have to do research. And actually, I did have to do a bit of research because it really doesn't fill in the holes very well.
She's famous, but the actual ins and outs of WikiLeaks is a bit inside baseball.
It's a bit, yeah, it is, and it's complex, and it doesn't do a very good job of filling in those holes. And you could argue, well, there are various newspaper reports that can do that, but I felt like it sort of dodged the difficult stuff a bit. However, you do get a good sense of her. You get her on the campaign trail. She's trying to get into the Senate. There's a sort of Democrat primary race, which she loses heavily. But
I feel like we didn't really hear very much about that. That when I was reading your piece, that was news to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
That wasn't very big news.
No,
at the time.
It wasn't.
I think she was a bit of a no-hoper.
She was a bit of a no-hoper, and she got absolutely crushed by her opponent. But it was
a significant thing to do. It's a very grand gesture.
Yeah, it was a significant thing to do. And she's a big Twitter presence, and so there was a lot of noise on Twitter about that. And then
is it a significant thing that because blue-collar middle America of either political tribe are going to be unsettled by her? Because being a traitor in America is a thing far more, I would imagine, readily expressed, more pronounced, more viscerally despised.
Particularly a traitor who did things that exposed the army. That wasn't love. And actually,
plus she's trans, which people
well,
don't...
Well, exactly, and I was going to say, it's really interesting when you were talking before about Paul Ryan and his comments. It seems that being transgender somehow becomes a part of her crime.
Absolutely. So the Wall Street Journal called her a gender celebrity and said it was an act of political correctness to release her. Now, Obama's releasing her. It had nothing to do with her transgenderism.
And yet this is a film that is called XY Chelsea. So her transgender identity is utterly bound up with it.
It is. It's called XY Chelsea because that's her Twitter handle. But then you could also say that she's chosen her Twitter handle because her identity is very much, you know, her identity as a public person
is very
much bound up. She is. And she, so I said, so you know, her two things that she campaigns for are transparency and trans rights.
Yeah.
And those things are aligned.
Is it possible to ever imagine this story playing out if she was still If she had no trans issues whatsoever, if she'd got into the army as Bradley Manning, stayed as Bradley Manning, does her fate as it currently sits now change?
We've had films about Edward Snowden.
Yeah, we've had films about Edward Snowden, and actually there was an enormous amount about her when she was still Bradley.
Yeah.
I think it adds another component, and it adds another component.
But would she have been let out sooner? Would she be back in prison? I mean, it's impossible to know this, but is there a sense, at least, an argument made that...
I don't think she's back in prison now because she's transgender. I think she's back in prison now because she refuses to testify before the grand jury. And I think what people say about her, and the way she, you know, the discourse around her is absolutely bound up in her transgenderism and, you know, the sort of her traitorishness and her transgenderism for certain people are combined.
Letting down a patriarchal male ideal within an army.
Yeah.
People of a certain bent would say, would accuse her of that by simply transitioning there. So that shows you she's not fit for the sort of the man's army.
And then of course, not long after Trump comes in, he bans transgender people in the military anyway. So of course, you know, that's another political angle. Interestingly, when her sentence is commuted by Obama, Democrats and Democrat politicians are quite quiet. So they've sort of decided they don't. I don't think it's so much the transgenderism, but it's the sort of perceived traitorishness. They didn't really come out and say this was a fantastic decision. They just sort of didn't say anything.
No Democrat who's seen to be anti-military is going to prosper in
prosper
in America, is she?
Exactly.
Are they? So where is she in the culture wars? Because she sort of raises various issues. She embodies various issues of the sort of, you know, free speech versus censorship, the consequences of information being circulated online. She's right at that. Then there's the transgender issue, which is again the heart of. She feels she's a figure at the centre of the cultural wars that go on. Does she know that she is?
I think she does know. And actually, you know, it goes both ways. I think there are lots of people on the left who say she's being treated unfairly because she's transgender. And I think, in a way, that's no better than people saying that, you know, she should be treated badly because she's transgender. I think, although her campaigning is bound up in both her transgenderism and her demands for transparency, I think they are different things, and I think they shouldn't be confused, and yet they are. And I think absolutely it says a lot about the culture wars that she's sort of this polarizing figure. You know, either there's not a lot of nuance about her, and
same with Assange as well. Interestingly, in a different sense, he is both a figure who is a martyr to free speech at one level, but is also a suspected rapist at another, and so the prosecution of Assange is now clouded. Is it an act of legitimate prosecution to test out whether he is guilty of the things he's accused of, or is that a proxy for silencing him?
Exactly. It's very interesting. It's a bit of a nasty coincidence that, you know, because of his potential rape case or whatever, that it's become that way. It's obviously complicated as well by the fact that he's been useful to Trump. So Trump, who, you know, doesn't like traitors, doesn't like people leaking government secrets or whatever, massively prospered by the Edward Snowden leak, which came via WikiLeaks and which, you know, incriminated Hillary Clinton, or at least exposed Hillary Clinton. So he's said things in support of Assange, and now he's backtracking on that, and it becomes very, very, very complicated.
And this isn't a film to unpick all that. This is quite a slight film.
Quite a slight film. What I did like about it was the closeness you get to Manning. So I didn't, you know, I didn't have, because she's been inside for so much, and although she's done interviews subsequently or whatever, I didn't have much sense of her as an individual. And that close up, you know, the director keeps out of it. You don't hear any voiceover or anything like that. You just get lots of Chelsea Manning hanging out with her friends, her campaign team, her, you know, sort of her political supporters doing stuff, and that was quite nice. But it's a companion piece to the wider story.
Toby Lichtig, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In November 2018, the TLS published a symposium asking a selection of historians, including Mary Beard, Edward Luttwak and Timothy Snyder, a simple question. To what extent is it helpful and or accurate to describe President Donald Trump as a fascist? Mary Fulbrook, whose book Reckonings, Legacies of Nazi Persecution and the Quest for Justice won the Wolfson History Prize earlier this month, summed things up neatly. While the description is not entirely accurate, a comparison is helpful, or at least must give us cause for thought. There are, she said, worrying parallels. But if you're thinking this exercise reductive, sensational even, it might be worth taking a longer view of the present moment and reflecting on the American mood before, during, and to a degree after the Second World War. The scope of Nazi influence was considerably greater than historians have until recently appreciated. In this week's TLS, the historian Eric Rauchway considers two new books that shed light on an uncomfortable past: Hitler's American Friends by Bradley Hart and The Unwanted by Michael Dobbs. He joins us on the line to tell us more now. Hello, Eric.
Good morning or afternoon, whatever it may be where you are.
Both.
Okay. Podcast, it's amazing. It's any time, yeah.
Yes.
Given the history of America's race relations, the prevalence, for one thing, of eugenicist thought and policy, isn't that surprising that this was a society primed and ready for Hitler's influence, is it?
No. I mean, the United States had a long history, of which Hitler was personally quite envious, of racist policymaking, which included, as you say, eugenics laws for the sterilization of unfit individuals, and exclusionary immigration policy, which was pretty much entirely racist in its orientation, keeping out pretty much all of Asia and much of Eastern and Southern Europe. And those were things that inspired, to a degree, Hitler and the Nazis. So it's scarcely surprising, as you say, that the Nazis should in turn have found some adherence among American citizens.
Well, you point out in your opening, you say even the blood supplies of the United States Army during the Second World War were segregated by race.
Yes, the United States, of course, has a long tradition of segregation, focused principally on African Americans, though not exclusively. There are fairly wide-ranging exclusions for Mexicans and for Asian folks as well. So, yes, I mean, if you look at that the sort of the two sides fighting on the Western Front in the Second World War, it's really the racists versus the Nazis, and you kind of have to root for the racists.
How much was there this an anti-war feeling generally, which is partially based on a sense of national identity, I suppose, that whatever Hitler was doing, it wasn't for America to intervene. Was some of this sympathy masked by pacifism?
Well, there were some genuine pacifists, to be sure, but it's hard to tease that apart from sort of sympathetic nationalists and fascists. The sense that America first was a sustainable policy was mostly focused on the sense that the United States ought to be doing its kind of nationalist exclusionary policy, while the Germans could do their kind of nationalist exclusionary policy, and the two could exist on opposite sides of the Atlantic.
And how acceptable is that? Was that as an opinion? Was that an opinion that was uttered in polite society in the late 30s?
I guess it depends what you think of as polite. I mean, you know, the major newspapers, certainly the widest circulation newspapers, like those of William Randolph Hearst, had the slogan "America First" right there above the title of the papers. So it was fairly, and Hearst published columns by Mussolini and Hitler, and himself clearly favored some kind of nationalistic dictatorship, at least through part of the 1930s. How polite was William Randolph Hearst? He was very vulgar, as you know, in many respects, but he certainly had an audience. And there were people who were more respectable, at least superficially respectable, again, looking at publishers of newspapers who spread these opinions pretty widely. Then, of course, there were major diplomats in the American State Department who really didn't want to have anything to do with hindering the progress of Nazism, which was deeply unfortunate for would-be Jewish refugees from Nazi-occupied Europe.
So what do we learn from Bradley Hart's book then? I mean, how deep-seated was the pro-fascist feeling, and how did it manifest or not? You know, how did it remain sort of implicit?
It's much more widespread than one would have thought. I think there are certainly tens of thousands of adherents of various fascist/Nazi organizations. These include things like the German-American Bund, which is perhaps more obvious, but also the an organization called the Silver Shirts, which were a bit more American-styled Nazis. There were also the Christian Front. So if you add all these together, you get some tens of thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands of fellow travelers or sympathizers. And then, perhaps even more alarmingly, there are highly placed officials in the United States government, including some senators and congressmen, who were more than happy during the debate over American aid to Britain to take Nazi propaganda and to distribute it through the mails or to insert it into their speeches. So I think if you take all that together, you find a rather troubling pattern.
You mention in the piece one Nazi agent was writing speeches for U.S. legislators, which is quite remarkable.
Yeah, if you look at the Justice Department's investigation of Nazi propaganda influence in this period, they have a list of perhaps two dozen senators and congressmen who had Nazi propaganda turning up in their publications or speeches. They're not sure, of course, how many of them were witting agents of the Nazi propagandists, but they're pretty sure about Ernest Lundeen and perhaps a few others who Hart talks about in his book.
It's a bit like a James Ellroy novel, this actually. These Nazi, racist, explicitly fascist people at the center of decision making.
It's very much like that. You know, there's a very much of a sort of real live film noir aspect where the sort of the sleaziest and the shadiest and the fringiest of people are hanging out with people at the very top of politics.
Yeah, we've headlined your piece "Selling to Suckers," which has sort of carries that noirish. The noirish feel. America First became notorious with Donald Trump. How toxic a phrase was that, and at what point was it toxic? I mean, it's an interesting thing. When he uses the phrase America First and was happy for that, was that consciously, subconsciously, blatantly a return to what was a very clearly fascistic nationalist slogan?
I cannot pretend to see inside the president's mind, but I can tell you that, you know, for maybe three decades before the Second World War, it was a phrase that knocked about American politics and culture for a long time. Woodrow Wilson tried to use it for a non-nationalist, non-fascistic agenda, but that didn't last very long, and it was very quickly taken over by the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, and by opponents of immigration, and by people we would nowadays call isolationists and other nationalists, and as I mentioned, William Randolph Hearst. And it stuck in that side of the political spectrum right up through, as you say, the America First Committee, which was established in the fall of 1940 after the Nazis had occupied Western Europe and, of course, were bombing Britain to oppose American intervention. And that was really how it got discredited. You know, it was associated with that cause. And it really didn't pop up again until Trump's picking it up when he decided to run for
would
president.
It have been a loaded term? I guess it's impossible, as you say, to know what he would know, but was it a loaded term even to be used, do you think? Would enough people know it was loaded?
I think anybody who knew what it was would know that it was loaded.
At its height, it had 800,000 odd members, and former presidents Gerald Ford, JFK was a member.
Well, Gerald Ford would have been very young, and JFK also, I mean, in 1940, and certainly there were a number of young people who didn't want to go to war, especially, JFK was the child of a defeatist American official, Joseph Kennedy, who John Kennedy later had to slightly repudiate in order to run for president. So
it's another James that's another James Elroy novel, actually.
Indeed. Yeah, exactly. So there were, as you say, a number of later prominent people who had been in it. And as I say, it's quite understandable that if you were a young person in 1940, looking back at the First World War, you wouldn't necessarily want to go to war.
How much is anti-Semitism an issue here? Because this is an issue, I suppose, where the Nazis overtly by the mid-1930s were pushing anti-Semitic agenda. How was that playing strongly in America, or is that being overlooked, or was it being valued by some people?
That's one of those things where it was clearly not supposed to be something that a decent person said very loudly, but that it was said quite softly or privately, or in the case of Charles Lindbergh, the America First spokesman, in his diary, that was quite common. And I mentioned this in the essay. Bradley Hart cites some polls of the late 1930s showing increasing anti-Semitism in the United States. You know, as many as a third of Americans or so wanted the federal government to take action to stop Jews from gaining power, whatever that sort of meant. And a much smaller but significant number wanted the United States to deport Jews. The official immigration policy of the United States from 1924 onwards seriously restricted immigration from Eastern Europe, and that was, of course, where most Jews were coming from. That was not a coincidence. And very many State Department officials had one or another kind of, I suppose we would call it, genteel anti-Semitic attitudes that interfered with their being sympathetic to refugees.
And I guess the question, just final question, is: what's the legacy today? Do you feel I think you make a point at the end of your piece that things might be different if Americans had retained an anti-fascism or developed an anti-fascistic attitude in the same way they developed an anti-communistic attitude, which was the thing that shaped the rest of the century.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's there has been, you know, for some decades, the idea of a so-called brown scare floating around in the literature of American history of this period, saying that the United States government went after fascists. But it appears, in light of Bradley Hart's book particularly, that the brown scare wasn't of adequate scope to the actual threat, I suppose. And certainly it wasn't anywhere near the level of the Red Scare after the war. And the hunting down of people who were associated with communism was, as you know, very energetic in the late 40s and the early 50s, whereas the hunting down of people who had been associated with fascist causes, including many businessmen and politicians who actively abetted Nazism, was nowhere near so industrious. So, I think it we might have seen a very different post-war landscape had there really been such a tenth of such energy devoted to rooting out fascism.
I mean, you could say that for Italy as well. All of these countries that sort of fail to reckon with fascism in the immediate aftermath of war, they're all the countries that are seeing a version of it coming back.
That's interesting.
Yeah, even in, you know, Allied occupied Germany, denazification kind of slowed down and stalled pretty quickly.
Well, they often needed Nazis, didn't they, or ex-Nazis, to do the spying against Russia, didn't they? That became a practical necessity.
That was the concern that they principally cited. Yeah.
But potentially, just not there was not much systemic keenness to do anything other than that. Is the point you're making?
Well, and of course, that was the original excuse for admiring or favoring or letting the Nazis do their job, is that they were a bulwark against advancing Soviet power.
Well, that's a whole other podcast, I feel, Eric. Interesting, and though it certainly is. Eric Rauchway, what a great pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I always find fascinating about Germany, Thea, is that they really, ironically, they've dealt with the legacy of the war.
Again and again and again.
And they're very peaceable.
They're defined by it.
Yeah, and it's the outcome for their society post-Cold War as unification has been... It seems to have handled it better than, say, Italy has.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
And then there's an interesting question there to float, that other countries like Britain and America, which you feel
because they were on the right side of history in the Second World
War.
They
haven't had to confront, they haven't had to do the reckoning.
No,
they've made... That Germany has had to. So, yeah. You know, the fact that there was, you know, and we've just been looking at America, but there was loads of sympathy over here as well in the UK.
There was.
Well, yeah.
We did, yeah, but the fascists, the brown shirts, yeah. The, you know, Edward VIII was pal of Hitler, you know.
Yeah,
the
exactly. It was all very cozy.
And anti-Semitism among the upper classes was a huge British thing. Mm. I'm not saying it doesn't exist now, but in the 30s it was you can't read. I mean, it's no coincidence you cannot read a book in the 1920s or 30s that is Anglophone.
Yeah.
Almost without someone making an anti-Semitic remark.
Yeah.
That's all we've got time for this week. Alas, our thanks go to Claire Loudon, Toby Lichtig and Eric Rauchway. Please make sure you do get a copy of the TLS this week. Honestly, I'm not going to lie to you. It is quite good. We look at all aspects of American culture, get a dispatch from William Boyd from France, try to identify Edith Wharton's dad, and have an account of the India-Pakistan cricket match from an Indian MP. All that and more. Next week, it is the centennial of Iris Murdoch.
You'll be on holiday, I think, won't you, Steve?
It's actually, I'm not on holiday.
Oh, no, of course not. No.
I'm not on holiday. I may even be here, Thea. I may not, but
there is a threat.
It is not confirmed that I will not be here.
Okay.
You'll have to find that out. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.